seen as a fuddy-duddy sort of Eastern religion, which was something of the past and no relevant to the present. And that's on one side. And the other side, Iran was going through huge sort of difficulties. You know, the dictatorship of Shah, and the fact that economically, politically, Iran was really bottom. And you know, the Shah was number one sort of agent and servant of the West. But it wasn't actually able to do anything for the ordinary Iranian people. There was such an unhappiness within Iran. And I remember going to Iran just a couple of years before. And when I came back, I was talking to everyone and saying, look, it's not going to go on like this. There's going to be a change. I didn't expect it to be so soon, but it was obvious that the situation in Iran cannot continue like that. You know, the poverty, the injustice, everything was so ripe. But what happened with the revolution was Ayatollah Khomeini brought the spirit of Islam as a revival, as a tsunami, not just for Iran, but the whole world. You know, even in South America, who weren't really followers of Islam by any definition, they were inspired by the revolution of Iran because it stood against the number one stooge of the United States, which was abusing his own people for the benefit of the that colonial power. And I think that was something which then, it was a tsunami. It affected the Palestinian movement. It affected the Islamic movement around the world. Mm. Islam was seen as a revival tool, an empowering tool, which could actually undermine the tyranny of the time.
Yes, we are going to speak more about the sort of ripple effect that the revolution had on the region, how it's helped other countries, other peoples as well. But Batul, I want to bring you in on this as well, because you perhaps represent a younger generation, of course, who perhaps look to the revolution still. Just tell me, what does the revolution mean to you, and what does it represent for you today?
Ultimately, to me, it represents dignity. It's a manifestation of the ayah from the Holy Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahim, kam min fa'atin qalilatin ghalabat fa'atin kathiratin bi'idhnillah. So how many times have an entity that's small in number and, let's say, a material strength has overcome an entity that's much larger in number and material strength by the way of God? So, of course, Islam is the determining factor, and it's the true identity for the people and for the society of Iran, which I think is something that really makes it stand out, is that Islam is not being used as a cover for the interests of those in power. In actual fact, Iran has had to basically let go of many short-term, you know, benefits or interests in pursuit of those higher objectives and in pursuit of those principles. And I see that Iran today in the region is probably the only country that's really standing as an obstacle to the Western imperialist project and has demonstrated that full hand. Not only is Iran stable today, but it's looking to create a new world order, one that that constitutes of respect, cooperation, growth, expertise. And look, it's been over four decades since the advent of the revolution. Its ideals are still very much within the hearts and minds of the Iranians, and I would say beyond. And I would say that for the younger generation, there's actually overpowering feelings. And we have to understand that this younger generation hasn't actually witnessed the revolution firsthand. It hasn't even witnessed the eight-year war. But look at the way that they, for example, commemorate their martyrs. You know, look at the way that today they commemorate the likes of Haj Qasim Soleimani. And this is all despite the soft war efforts to basically weaken and to target their faith. So we have to put it within that context. So I think that shows that the revolution has a dynamic understanding of the needs of the younger generation that are inherently attracted to it.
And of course, I think it's worth mentioning that Iran right now is facing a kind of Western pressure campaign, and in specific, they're focusing on things like the woman's rights in Iran. Yeah. Tell me, do you think that the Islamic Revolution has compromised on women's rights in Iran, or perhaps has empowered it, surprisingly, in another way?
I think the Islamic Revolution has actually taken away those factors that would otherwise abuse a woman essentially. I mean, if you look at the West, for example, you see that a woman is viewed as both a consumer and a merchandise. She's viewed as a product that buys and sells, and her worth is only seen insofar as she generates capital and revenue. Whereas you see that actually one of the core moral values and structures is to focus on the family institution, strengthening the family institution. The role of a mother, for example, that she plays in terms of nurturing the future generations, that's something that's very much focused upon, and the value of a woman inherently and instinctively, as well as her participation in wider society. We see that, for example, the hijab is seen as an essential component to strengthen the family institution and to also facilitate the role of a woman in wider society. Imam Khomeini, you know, very famously, when he was speaking to a group of men, he told them, you know, do you think it is your speeches that have brought down the Shah? It is these very women. Treat them with honour. What he was saying was that these women were leading at the forefront of the protest movements. They were disseminating the education. They were disseminating the information within wider society. The only caveat that I would say was placed was that the hijab is the means and is the vehicle through which a woman can interact in society to maximize that productivity and that effort. So I would say actually the obstacles that would take away a woman's productivity and potential have been removed, and actually she's been respected and honored for the output that she gives to society, as well as her innate role that she plays as a mother and as a wife.
Well, that's really insightful. Thank you so much for sharing. And Masood, I want to ask you about the work that you've done here in the UK. It's been very much focused on, you know, bringing Sunnis and Shias and different Muslims from different backgrounds together to kind of achieve a joint objective towards empowering Muslims and so on. But that's also something which the Islamic Revolution has tried to achieve on a bigger regional level. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Revolution was a reflection of what the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is. So when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, At-tasmu bihamdillahi jami'an, and orders you to come together, any Islamic movement has to put that as one of its sort of aims and objectives. You know, Islamic movements, so-called, who think they could go by creating fractions and grouping and, you know, theological sort of basis and ignore everyone else, it's going against that verses of Quran, and indeed against the concept of Islam. To unite, I mean, look, every Muslim and non-Muslim knows that for us to achieve our aspirations as Muslims, we need to unite, and we need to come together for those issues. And indeed, we need to even unite with others other than Muslim for those issues. To be involved in sort of sectarianism and so forth, it actually is counterproductive to that. So it was absolutely essential for the Islamic movement and the Islamic Revolution to have that as one of his aims and objectives, and I think that's essential for any Islamic movement.
Yes, of course, sectarianism is a poison which has plagued the region for far too long, and it's great to see Absolutely. That there is a nation, the Islamic Republic, in the Middle East, which is fighting against that. However, before we continue this discussion, I want to bring in and remind ourselves of a particular Quranic verse which is often associated with the Islamic Revolution. The verse in the fifth surah of the Quran tells us that Allah will always replace those who turn away from Him with people who are better and who will strive in the path of God, no matter how the disbelievers dislike it. Well, let's come back to the discussion now. Batul, I want to come back to you on this, because one thing which Iran has done very, very well since 1979 until now, which doesn't get nearly enough coverage, particularly in Western mainstream circles, is the effort that they've done to combat extremism, combat terrorism. In fact, Iran has played a huge role in defeating notorious terrorist groups like Daesh, for example, in Iraq. Perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit more for us.
Absolutely. I think at the crux of it, Iran has an open hand policy. So that is every oppressed individual, no matter what their background is, no matter what their religion is, no matter what system of governance they have in place, They will unite on the basis of causes and on the basis of those inherent values. So we see that, for example, when Iran had to fight, because Iraq had invaded essentially during the Iran-Iraq war, that did not stop it. The fact that the whole world was, you know, besieging and sanctioning Iran and all kinds of weapons and ammunition were used against them, still then, when they were at their lowest point in terms of material strength, did they still reach their hands out to the Palestinians to support them essentially in their fight against the occupation? It did the same thing in Lebanon. You know, Iran was crucial in the formation of Hezbollah and in their support, this Lebanese liberation group, which essentially defeated Israel in 2000 and drove them out. And Haj Qasem Soleimani is one of the individuals who is hailed as having a key role to play, essentially, in the imparting of the strategic, basically, advice and training that he had had. So ultimately, what it is that Iran has a vision. And that vision is that wherever there is oppression, that oppression needs to be uprooted. And that oppression is uprooted by giving the necessary support to those individuals on the ground and training them such that they can become self-sufficient to fight that enemy. You know, the overcoming of the enemy won't happen unless the individuals themselves on the ground want that to happen. So, for example, we see that even within the Palestinian liberation groups, they would train them how to create bullets, for example. They would train them how to create these tunnels. Rather than making them kind of dependent, they would seek to make them self-sufficient. And it sees the struggle as one united struggle against a greater enemy. So it's like Imam Khomeini defined America as the great Satan. So anyone that wants to support in weakening the hegemony of America, we will support in that pursuit. We will unite for that objective, essentially.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how nowadays you find that Iran has a relationship with many countries around the world who are not Muslim majority. Venezuela, for example, Iran has played a role in helping them. So, Masood, I'm going to come back to you, because it seems to me as if you look at how Iran is now to how it was back before 1979, the misconception is that Islam removes human rights, that Islam is anti-education for women, that type of thing. But actually, surprisingly, women education is at an all-time high in Iran. Literacy level has improved since the revolution, that type of thing. And now Iran is a world competitor in the field of sciences, sport, and so on. So perhaps you could elaborate on that point as well for us.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what the sister said regarding the saying of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, that women were instrumental in bringing the revolution. They were also the actual beneficiary. They benefited a lot more than the men in as a result of the revolution. The number of sort of women at universities, the number of judges, the number of the lecturers and professors, and politicians, it really is not possible to compare it with Shah's time. You know, at the Shah's time, the freedom for the women was dependent on the inches of the skirts. You know, the higher it went, you know, there were more freedom. Well, here you could actually measure it by empowerment of women to take their rightful place. But also, I think Iran, although was the number one importer and buying weapons from United States, when the war took place, Iran was not capable, didn't have the resources, except the manpower and the dedication of the Mujahideen to actually defend itself. Now Iran is a regional power. And when you look at all the other technology, you see that Iran is number five, number four, number seven in the world, despite all the sanctions and everything. I think what is really important is that we need to ask the question, why is it Iran being singled out with this sort of attack by global sort of West, day in, day out? Is it really anything to do with the human right, for example? You know, when we see the Saudis have actually given death penalty for someone for tweeting, and the world is completely silent, And then in Iran, someone gets death penalty for killing people in the demonstration in front of the international community and on the cameras. Then there is a huge opposition. So we need to actually be able to have a filter to understand that, you know, what is going on. There are at the moment 127 channels beaming sort of Farsi into Iran. I mean, this is not economical. This has all been fabricated. This has all been organized. This is really a tool of trying to undermine a country which is not just standing for is independent, but also is the aid for all others, including Venezuela, including South America and elsewhere.
You've mentioned, of course, a kind of criticism campaign against the Islamic Republic that does exist. Criticism ranges from things like they claim it's a dictatorship, they claim that, you know, Iran is being expansionist and is trying to pursue some kind of Persian Empire building project in the Arab world, that type of thing. How would you respond to this type of criticism? What would you say about it?
You know, I mean, look at forget the spins. Look at the reality. Look at the statistic. Look at the history. Iran hasn't invaded any country, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, Iran has actually, as the sister said, helped and support others to be able to empower themselves against one of the greatest atrocities against them, like the Palestinians, like the Lebanese, like Venezuela. You know, it really is not there to sort of colonize everywhere else. It's there to help and support, despite the fact that itself is under huge pressure, a pressure that sanctions.
But Tool, I want to bring you in because we haven't got a lot of time left before the end of the show. Again, I want to give you a chance to respond to some of the criticism. Other criticisms include, for example, that it's a revolution for Shia Muslims. You know, this is a Shia Muslim majority country. It's ultimately for them only. That's their main interest. How would you respond to that?
I just want to respond to the thing before that, and that is on the point of dictatorship. And it is that Iran is a very active and energetic nation. So in 1979, the whole world was seeking to crush this revolution. That was the whole point of the 8-year war. That's the whole point of the economic sanctions that we're seeing today, that Iran has turned from a challenge to an opportunity. So essentially, for someone to come and to say that it's a dictatorship, okay, Iran right now is being sanctioned for this revolution. Who is maintaining this revolution? What is its support base? Its support base is the people, because where else is it going to get that support? It doesn't have any kind of foreign support. And if you look at the inherent institutions within Iran, they're in such a way that they rest on the people. They're made up of the masses of the people. And they're designed to monitor each other. For example, just take the IRGC, the Besiege, for instance, these different institutions. So if today, if really and truly the Iranian nation today did not want an Islamic Republic, and the world is telling Iran that if you get rid of this Islamic Republic, we will remove these sanctions away from you, it doesn't make sense to say that the people in Iran actually are not happy and want to remove the system. Yes, they have their criticisms. Of course, they have their criticisms like in any other country. But what actually the people in Iran are asking for is for the government to get closer to the Islamic ideals. It's to get closer to the models. They have a problem with the reformist ideologies that is, you know, bringing about more of a neoliberal model. That's the kind of internal critique. A lot of internal criticism happens not to remove the Islamic component. It's like, oh, this revolution is meant to be based on full social justice, so we want to see more of that being enacted within internal policies. And of course, Iranians are very, very smart and politically aware and read. So they're aware of what the external reality is like. They're aware of the machinations of the enemy, essentially. And in terms of this question about it being, you know, Shias, I think, like Brother Masoud was saying, the reality speaks for itself. If Iran is going out, if Imam Khomeini went out of his way to cut ties with South Africa because of the apartheid, if Iran goes out of its way to be the only entity to ship oil and fuel to Venezuela that's under the same sanctions for the same pretext that Iran is in, and that is because it's trying to carve out its own trajectory and its own line, if Iran goes out of its way to support the Palestinian Liberation Group like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Haj Qasem Soleimani even himself stressed that we don't give weapons and support on the basis of whether you are Sunni, whether you are Shia, what your background is. You either surrender to the enemy or you face the enemy. That is ultimately what determines whether we will be supporting you or it's futile, essentially.
Unfortunately, Batul, we are out of time, but I think you've summarised your point very, very effectively. And to you, Sir Masood, thank you to you both for joining me, and thank you for everyone at home for tuning in as well. But don't worry, next week we'll be back for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Salaamu Alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Shortage of electricity in the UK has forced utilities to pay people to turn off lights. There are reports that more than a million households in England, Scotland and Wales will be paid to cut back their electricity usage between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. to prevent blackouts. It comes amid warnings that energy supplies will be tighter than normal on one of the coldest days of the year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Guardian, households and businesses in Britain will be paid to cut back on their electricity use between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. in the first real test of a national grid scheme. With temperatures dropping sharply, the electricity system operator hopes to reduce the strain on the grid by reducing consumption. The initiative, which has only been used as a test up to now, will take place during the early evening peak in Britain's energy demand. Through the smart meter, energy firms monitor usage every 30 minutes. Companies will give households 24 hours notice that a saving session is upcoming, and it will require customers to reduce their consumption by at least 30%. The greater the reduction, the greater the discount, which is automatically applied to the bill. Guardian also noted consumers are likely to use various methods to save power during the period, including making sure none of their devices are charging or pushing back meal times. A household's power use will be compared with their normal usage for that time of day, and they will receive about £3 for every kilowatt hour saved. Also, the website of RT wrote in this regard, more than a million UK homes and businesses are set to be paid to use less energy between 5 and 6 p.m. local time as part of the National Grid's Demand Flexibility Service aimed at preventing blackouts during periods of high usage. Customers with any of 26 UK energy suppliers can receive a small sum for cutting their usage below average levels during the one-hour period. National Grid announced recently, warning the country was facing tighter than normal supply margins. It is the first time the scheme has been implemented since it was announced last year, aside from this. The amount received varies depending on how much the customer is able to cut back their usual usage. With about £3 doled out for every kilowatt hour saved, estimated payouts run between £6 and £20. In case additional power is needed, three coal-fired power plants that were set to be retired in September amid the UK's green energy transformation have been placed on standby. National Grid revealed recently, however, the utility stressed that customers should not worry, insisting it was only implementing DFS and tapping the coal plants as precautionary measures to maintain the buffer of spare capacity they need. National Grid has previously warned that rolling three-hour blackouts may be possible during January and February in case of energy shortages. The UK imports about half of its energy and costs have skyrocketed as Western sanctions on Russia severely limited the available supply for participating countries. Critics have dismissed DFS, arguing it requires too much work for minimal savings. Others see it as an unfair penalty levied against those without smart meters installed, as only those customers whose homes or businesses are equipped with the controversial devices can participate. However, project head Craig Dyke has big plans, declaring DFS will drive forward towards net zero and calling it the start of something much, much bigger. Meanwhile, local news websites have reported that homes across Sussex are still without power after outages on Sunday morning, January 22nd. While plenty of homes have been restored, hundreds still remain unconnected due to the power outages. Homes in Easternbourne, Seaford and Willingdon are still affected. Engineers from UK Power Networks, UKPN, have said they are working to fix the issue, and it was initially hoped that all homes would have power returned by 7:30 p.m. on January 26th. UKPN has said the outages in Easternbourne were caused by an underground electricity cable has faulted on high-voltage network, causing an area-wide power cut. Meanwhile, the outage in Seaford has been put down a faulty piece of equipment which controls the power to the homes.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the U.S. role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the U.S. involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The U.S. military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became U.S. soldiers fighting an American war. Or in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the U.S. President Joe Biden stated that the U.S. and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the U.S. troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and U.S. special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while U.S. officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the U.S. and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the U.S. announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries such as Poland to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the U.S. provided its own tanks. The decision by the U.S. to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
confrontation between Russia and the West is getting more complicated after Germany and the United States announced their decisions to send advanced tanks to Kiev. The U.S. is sending 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. Biden told reporters at the White House that the tanks highlight America's enduring commitment to Ukraine.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
The reversal of the U.S.'s previous position came after Germany said it will send 14 of its Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Berlin has also given permission to partner countries to re-export other battle tanks to Kiev. Biden has praised the decision by Germany and stressed on what he called Western unity against Russia. Germany was reluctant to send tanks to Ukraine, was waiting for the U.S. to take the front lead. Britain had earlier announced that it would give Ukraine its Challenger tanks. While Berlin was concerned about escalating the war, Washington cited logistical and maintenance challenges. Western nations had so far refused to give heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine. Kiev is now pushing its Western allies to deliver fourth-generation fighter jets, such as the American F-16. But the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says there is no chance of any fighter jets being sent to Ukraine, despite renewed calls for high-end aircraft. Ukraine's Air Force has a fleet of aging Soviet-era fighter jets. Western military support has been vital for Kiev.
I follow the debate closely surrounding these tanks. You know, you do have a number of German officials and experts, commentators saying we can't have German tanks, you know, on the border with Russia again. This evokes terrible memories of World War II. But the counter argument to this is, because you hear a lot about Russia, is if you look at how Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, it invaded it through Ukraine and Belarus. So Germany also has a historic responsibility.
By announcing its decision to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine, Germany is now actively involved in the war with Russia. The German foreign minister has said that Germany and its allies are, quote, fighting a war against Russia. Comments have been described as rare and frank remarks about the Western role in the conflict. Sergei Nechayev, Russia's ambassador to Germany, said this extremely dangerous decision takes the conflict to a new level of confrontation and contradicts the statements of German politicians about Germany's unwillingness to get involved in it. Russia has harshly criticized the decision by NATO members to send heavy weaponry to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. The Kremlin has said that any Abrams battle tanks supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. would, quote, burn. Russian officials have dismissed the expected delivery as an expensive folly. The U.S. Defense Department announced in early January 2023 that it would give an additional $3.1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. In total, the U.S. approved about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine in 2022. About half of that money, or $24.9 billion, went towards military spending. The U.S. also gave $9.6 billion to Ukraine for what it has described as non-military purposes in 2022. It is believed that the small number of Western-supplied tanks manned by poorly trained crews and lacking maintenance and supply infrastructure support is likely to yield negative results. Furthermore, the first deployment of U.S. main battle tanks in Ukraine must come by a significant Ukrainian army success. That would require no fewer than 200 to 300 tanks. The question is whether Western countries are prepared to go for a full-blown confrontation with Russia.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernandez, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries, so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister, Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive. Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the U.S. and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the U.S. dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of U.S. dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the U.S. dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of U.S. dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999. While the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like SCO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the U.S. dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years. Mm-hmm.
United States and yet again another shooting with mass fatalities. Around a dozen people were killed and about the same number were injured in a mass shooting in the largely Asian city of Monterey in Southern California. Eyewitnesses said the assailant opened fire indiscriminately with a semi-automatic weapon at an event in Monterey Park as the local community was celebrating Chinese Lunar New Year. Captain Andrew Mayer of L.A. Sheriff's Department said officers had responded to emergency calls at around 10:20 p.m. on Saturday and found people pouring out of the premises. He said the officers made entry to the location and located additional victims. Police say the victims were transported to numerous local hospitals and were listed in various conditions from stable to critical. Witnesses said there was a shooter with a machine gun who had multiple rounds of ammunition on him so he could reload. It is still unknown whether the suspect knew his victims or whether it was a targeted attack. Investigations are underway into the shooting to find out the motive behind it and whether or not the incident was a hate crime. But the factors that lead to tragedies like the one in Monterey Park are deeply ingrained in U.S. politics, culture, and law. As defined by the Gun Violence Archive, a mass shooting is an incident during which four or more people are shot. The Monterey incident is the 33rd such mass shooting that has taken place in the U.S. already since the beginning of this year. It follows shootings at an MLK Day celebration in Fort Pierce, Florida, and a shooting that killed six people in Goshen, California, on that very same day. The Monterey shooting also follows numerous such events last year, including at a Walmart in Virginia, the one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a shooting on a school bus allegedly targeting members of the University of Virginia football team, and a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois last summer. The United States experienced 647 mass shootings last year, illustrating the severity of the issue with guns. The mass shootings in the U.S. come as no other country has suffered such a high death toll from gun violence. Every day, more than 110 Americans die at the end of a gun, including suicides and homicides, an average of more than 40,000 per year. In 2020 alone, more than 45,000 Americans died at the end of a gun, whether by homicide or suicide, more than any other year on record. In terms of the number of incidents, since 2009, there has been an annual average of 19 shootings in which at least four people are killed. The U.S. gun homicide rate is as much as 26 times that of other high-income countries. Its gun suicide rate is nearly 12 times higher. This, as gun control opponents have typically framed the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. as a symptom of a broader mental health crisis. Every country has people with mental health issues and extremists. Those problems aren't unique. What is unique in the U.S.'s expansive view of civilian gun ownership, ingrained in politics, in culture, and in the law since the nation's founding, and a national political process that has so far proved incapable of changing that norm? In terms of the number of guns in the U.S. and how they contribute to the related violence, one estimate from the Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 390 million guns in circulation in the U.S. in 2018, or about 120.5 firearms per 100 residents. More recent data also suggests that gun ownership grew significantly over the last several years. One study published by the Annals of Internal Medicine in February found that 7.5 million U.S. adults, just under 3% of the population, became first new gun owners between January 2019 and April 2021. But what are the causes of gun violence in the U.S.? Easy access to firearms, a lack of comprehensive background checks and regulations, social and economic factors such as poverty, racism, and mental illness could be named as such. When it comes to the National Rifle Association, the NRA lobbies heavily against all forms of gun control and argues that more guns make the country safer. Despite years of financial woes and internal strife, the NRA remains the most powerful gun lobby in the United States, with a substantial budget to influence members of Congress on gun policy. In January, the NRA filed for bankruptcy as part of a fraud case against some of its own senior staff. Over the last several election cycles, the NRA and other organizations have consistently spent more on pro-gun rights messaging than their rivals in the gun control lobby. Who supports gun control? Despite widespread and vocal public outrage, often in the wake of gun violence, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014, according to polling by Gallup. 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. 11% surveyed said laws should be made less strict. Last year, Congress reached a deal on limited gun reforms for the first time in nearly 30 years, but the recent shootings underscored just how embedded gun violence is in the U.S. To the solutions. Some argue for stricter gun control laws, such as universal background checks, banning certain types of weapons, and increasing funding for mental health services. Others argue for a more permissive approach, such as loosening restrictions on gun ownership and emphasizing the importance of the Second Amendment.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, one of the enduring mysteries surrounding the chaotic attempts to overturn Donald Trump's defeat in the 2020 presidential battle has been solved. who made a secret $1 million donation to the controversial election audit in Maricopa County, Arizona. It turns out that person was Donald Trump himself. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of HillReporter.com has covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump's deeply corrupt Save America PAC has been exposed for having secretly funneled $1 million to the sham audit in Arizona that Donald Trump supporters hoped would overturn the 2020 election. An analysis by the watchdog group documented traced funding for the Arizona audit back to the Save America PAC. Under Arizona law, electoral candidates are not allowed to fund vote recounts, which have to be financed with taxpayer dollars. Documenter's research shows that discussions around a possible payment from Donald Trump to the Arizona audit began in June of 2021. The group tracked the money as it first passed from Trump's fund through an allied conservative group and then onto a shell company, which in turn then handed the money to contractors and individuals involved in the Arizona audit. The January 6th House Select Committee also highlighted how the Save America PAC gave $1 million to the Conservative Partnership Institute, the CPI, whose top officials included Donald Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Cyber Ninjas, the Florida-based company that led the Arizona audit, disclosed in 2021 that $5.7 million of its budget came from several far-right groups invested in the Stop the Steal campaign to overturn Joe Biden's presidential win. Though the Cyber Ninjas audit was technically not a recount, it served a similar purpose and worked to hide the financial ties to Donald Trump. At the time, the same Republican leaders of the Arizona Senate who asked Cyber Ninjas to carry out the audit publicly denied that Donald Trump was involved, saying this absolutely has nothing to do with Donald Trump. But a further $1 million had been donated to the audit from an account controlled by Cleta Mitchell, a Republican election lawyer who advised Donald Trump during his lame duck period as he attempted to stay in office. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump reportedly made a secret $1 million donation to a partisan-driven audit of Arizona's election result in his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. It was Mr. Trump who largely bankrolled the discredited review of election results, which the president hoped would support his baseless claims that the election was stolen from him and swing the outcome in his favour. The revelation comes as it also emerged that Donald Trump's attorney, John Eastman, is facing disciplinary charges and potential disbarment in California over his involvement in the former president's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. This weekend, Donald Trump is set to begin his 2024 presidential campaign trail this weekend, with back-to-back appearances in New Hampshire and in South Carolina on Saturday, 28th of January. It comes at the end of a week where parent company Meta announced that it would reinstate his Facebook and Instagram accounts in the coming weeks. A $1 million donation to the group responsible for the sham audit of Arizona's Maricopa County election results in 2020 came from Donald Trump's Save America PAC, according to analysis of publicly available data by the watchdog group Documented. The analysis was based on campaign finance disclosures, tax filings, and communications records obtained by another transparency group. It contradicts statements made by the former president's associates, who denied he had anything to do with the effort to audit election results in Arizona's most populous county, the Maricopa County. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. An analysis by the watchdog group